My name is Lorenzo Morris, and I'm the interim chair of the Political Science Department at Howard University. And I'd like to welcome you to our very special program on affirmative action and the issues before the United States Supreme Court. We have a particularly distinguished panel this afternoon, so I have been encouraged by my friends not to talk as much as usual, and I will fully succeed in doing that. And I will introduce each of them as they make their statement. But the issue before us are the concerns, not uniquely, but principally, the Supreme Court cases now up for debate that we will hear on Tuesday. And we expect to have a number of people that you've seen on the panel, I believe. Just a moment. Why didn't you sit here? We were expecting some of our panelists to come late, and they arrive on time. There's just no accounting for things anymore. And I've asked them to speak alphabetically, but I wanted the congressman to speak last because he wasn't supposed to get here until late. So we might. Oh, he would be glad to go first. I'm really pleased then to start without any great analysis. Well, I do have one point, one advantage of age. I think for those who are too young to remember, 1978 was an important date in the progress of the issues of affirmative action. When I came here, it was from a university in Cambridge, it was because I was fascinated by the importance to public policy of the case that was about to be decided, the Bakke case. And I was surprised by the enthusiasm of many with the decision that it had helped to support, the Bakke case, affirmative action. But I felt that I shared with most people a sense of skepticism and concern that it may have marked a long-term threat to affirmative action that would soon be played out. And I actually wrote that down in a publication which I will spare you a citation from, but I want to make the point that I was probably typical of many, and if I was wrong in anything about that, it was perhaps in expecting that the ultimate test would take only a short period of time. This may not be, as we face Tuesday, the ultimate test, but if it isn't, I would be surprised. And I think, therefore, in terms of public policy, in terms of university policy, in terms of our understanding of merit and equal opportunity, we are faced with a very important issue, and that is why we have such an extraordinarily distinguished panel today. And without elaborating their distinction, since they're known to many of us, I am very pleased to introduce Congressman Shaka Fatah, from the representative from Pennsylvania.
Thank you very much. And let me apologize for not knowing exactly when I would arrive, but I don't control my own schedule when the Congress is in session, and we have to make do as we can make do. But I want to, first of all, thank the moderator and the fellow panelists, and particularly I say how great it is to see the dean again, and who in his former life was in my shoes as an elected official. Let me say, in terms of the essence of this case coming before the Supreme Court on the 1st of April, that it threatens the aspirations of generations of African Americans and Latino students who want to pursue higher education, graduate school education. It will have impacts even beyond the doors of academic pursuits in employment and in other aspects. The Bush administration, in filing a brief in the court, has put the full power of the executive office and the Justice Department behind the arguments of the three white students who were denied admission. And they were denied admission, and others were admitted who had, in the eyes of the university, met the qualifications of the system of admissions. And when you analyze it, it is very different than as President Bush talked about it. He gave one impression of it, but when you really look at the Michigan Affirmative Action program, I think it is defensible. And therefore, I organized a group of my colleagues in the Congress, and we filed a brief, and we made a particular argument. But the point of note is that there have been all kinds of briefs filed on the side of having the Michigan admissions program determined to be constitutional. The briefs filed by the 60 members of Congress, including myself, argued to the court that the court should take note of the disparities in educational opportunity that are present today in each of our states and throughout the country, and have been noted through all manner of study by various instruments of both the government and other research entities. There were briefs filed by military officials who argued that our effectiveness in the prosecution of armed conflict would be impaired if we did not have affirmative action, and if they were not able to utilize it. There was arguments made on behalf of the loss of science, scientific discovery, if certain people were continued to be locked out of the possibility of the of pursuit of academic knowledge in the field of science. Those who put forth the law school admissions test argued that, as a friend of the court, that the test should never be used as a sole criteria for the admission into law school. And I thought that the university's own brief really attacked the heart of the argument brought by these students and those who support them, because it showed that in each and every instance, those who have been admitted or were fully qualified to be admitted, and that the issue of diversity itself in a academic environment at the university, that it was enriched by having people of racial and geographical and economic diversity, and I thought they made a compelling case in that regard. So I'm very happy to be just one of many people who have organized themselves, and I want to commend the law students here who organized and got a brief in. I think it's very important that we not be spectators. No matter what the decision of the court, it's critically important that we assert our interests. And when we have publicly funded universities that are paid for by taxpayers, and no groups are eliminated from that pool, so it's not like if you're an African American or Latino, you don't have to pay taxes. That we cannot have those universities create a dynamic sanctioned by law that somehow disallows real access to those schools for those young people in our communities, in which those schools would, in their minds, be the best choice for them in terms of pursuing an education. So I want to thank you. I'm going to listen to a few of my colleagues here, much more learned on these matters, I'm sure, than I. But I want to thank you all for your interest.
There are, by the way, a number of activities related to this case, which I will hopefully get a chance to bring to your attention later. But I am struck by the praise issued for our next speaker for those who know his contribution to the preparation of briefs in the court case. Mark Dan from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. And this is, of course, an important organization in representing diverse but largely progressive interests that they are confronted in the American judicial system and in public life. Mark Dan.
The way the order worked on the panel plays out fairly well, because I thought what I would provide for the discussion is somewhat of a primer for certain terminologies and the history of how the Supreme Court has addressed affirmative action or race consciousness in its decisions, so that you would understand a little bit of those terms that the nine justices will be utilizing and most of the lawyers in their briefs have utilized. I helped write the brief on behalf of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, which also was co-authored and had as other signatories the NAACP's National Office, as well as the Women's National Women's Law Center and a number of other groups. So certainly I, along with the rest of my colleagues, can answer questions, and we look forward to the Q&A. But just as a brief primer, generally the use of race-conscious measures is adjudicated at the Supreme Court level under what's referred to as strict scrutiny. Now, strict scrutiny The test for that is the state using race-conscious measures must have a compelling state interest, and their use of that race interest must be narrowly tailored to that government interest. The prototypical example being remedying past discrimination. So, for example, a sheriff's department, if you happen to be lucky enough to find the case where the sheriff actually wrote down that I am not hiring Latinos, period, writes it, signs it, gets it notarized, and then is sued. Subsequently, the state, that sheriff's department, can utilize race-conscious measures. A court can come in, set a quota for the next 5 years in order to remedy that past discrimination. For instance, you must, in your recruiting and your promotions, promote one Latino officer for every two Caucasian officers for the next 5 years. So that's how the court would utilize a narrow use of race consciousness to remedy the compelling state interest of eliminating the past discrimination. The test was developed under the paradigm of majority population, Caucasians, discriminating against people of color. Both contracts, you hear a lot of cases in contracting, government and state, federal contracting, as well as enrollments in schools and elsewhere. Now, when affirmative action began to be challenged, that paradigm didn't quite work. And so, for a number of years, the courts were struck with a distinct question of how to, if at all, use strict scrutiny. The first case, of course, as you are aware, was the University of California v. Bakke. Now, just for a quick explanation, that was a white applicant to the University of California Medical School. Now, their admission program was set up in such a way that they had what's referred to as set-asides. Out of the 100 students that would be admitted to that med school for each year, 16 of those seats were reserved and set aside for students of color. Now, when that decision was argued before the Supreme Court, the decision resulted in what's referred to as a plurality. Four justices shot down the admissions process. Four justices would have upheld the admissions process, and then one justice, Justice Powell, who you probably know has been influential in this, his decision hit the middle ground, and that's the decision the Supreme Court is currently facing. Now, Justice Brennan and Marshall and the four justices who would have upheld the decision would have utilized what's referred to as intermediate scrutiny. They would not have required such a compelling test to be used. They thought that since this use of race was clearly not designed to be discriminatory whatsoever, but rather to adjust what the court later called general societal harms and face up to those harms, this was a permissible use of race. The other four, led by Justice Stevens at that time, did not wish to address the issue whatsoever. They relied on Title VI, a statute, and said, given the statute, we don't need to reach this issue. We don't need to reach this question. The modern day equivalent of that answer would be Justice Scalia's notion of colorblindness, where any use of race is completely impermissible, period. End of story. What Justice Powell's decision said was, regardless of everything else, the first statement is that diversity for a university of higher education is a compelling state interest. Therefore, the university overcame the first part of the two-prong test. However, the second prong, whether it was narrowly tailored, Justice Powell said it was not. Set-asides, quotas, those admissions processes that would require students of color to go through a different admissions committee, not compete, where Caucasian students could only compete for 84 seats, but students of color could compete for 100 seats. That was narrowly tailored. Bakke, as I'm sure my other colleagues will note, is at the time had most amicus briefs filed ever before the Supreme Court. I believe we beat that with Michigan. Now, what the universities, many of the universities were filing amicus briefs at the time, immediately following the decision, of course, Every university read it with precision. Their lawyers read it with precision. And across the country, universities began complying with what Justice Powell, as the definitive single opinion, said, and started utilizing diversity. Now, subsequent decisions went back and forth in terms of how to use, if at all, strict scrutiny. Other school cases said you can't use role model theories, teachers in high schools. You can't argue that it's a compelling interest to have role models, students who, teachers who look like their students in the front of the classroom as role models. That's too amorphous. Subsequently, Justice O'Connor, when she joined the court, finally reached a majority opinion with a 5-4 decision stating that states must use must overcome strict scrutiny. That case was City of Richmond v. Croson. Now, that was a contracting case. Subsequently, back and forth since 1990 to 1995, there was a question of whether the federal government had to face that same strict scrutiny and overcome that. Subsequently, in 1995, Adiran Construction Incorporated, Pena, decided that, yes, the federal government had to comply with that same standard. Those were all contracting cases. This left unresolved the schools, the universities. Right now, currently, there's a split between the circuits. The Fifth Circuit, which has Texas, says because of these subsequent cases, Justice Powell's decision is no longer good law. That's why the University of Texas now has equal access, the 10% plans you've probably heard a great deal about. Similarly, University of Washington, in a case called Smith v. University of Washington, said, no, Justice Powell's decision is still good law until the 9 justices of the Supreme Court say otherwise. However, politically, race-conscious measures and admissions in the state of Washington were eliminated by referendum, similarly to California. Now in Johnson, down in Georgia, University of Georgia, another court said, no, Bakke is no longer good law. So that's an even split, with the University of Michigan saying, yes, it is. So that brings us to the present case, which I'll defer to my colleagues to speak a little bit more about. Other than to let you know right now, there are actually 4 cases being litigated, in a manner of speaking. One for the law school, one for the undergraduate university. Now, in defense of the affirmative action race-conscious measures, you have the universities in both instances saying, our reason for this is diversity. However, what you need to recognize is there's 2 other defenses for each case by the impleaders. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund, along with the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, are advancing additional reasons, saying the university is stuck between a rock and a hard place. They can't admit to prior discrimination, or they will get sued. So they're stuck using diversity solely. However, these impleaders are saying, with a wink and nod, and having advanced substantial evidence, that indeed the university has a history of discrimination, and these remedies, these admissions policies currently remedy that past history of discrimination. So that's the lay of the land, and I'll pass it along to my colleagues.
Well, I do want to say a word of introduction, and we only award water after they speak. No, I'm sorry, the bottom of my cup is a slow process, you know, affirmative action, whatever. But I think you've already introduced your colleagues, 2 of the students from involved in the brief, and I don't know which one of you is going to speak first.
I'll introduce. Hi, I'm Robin Conrad, and I'm a 3rd-year law student at Howard. And Nadine Jones Francis and I are going to talk to you a little bit about the brief that we co-authored and submitted on behalf of the students at the law school. I just want to tell you a little bit about why we decided to go ahead and write this brief. When the Supreme Court decided that they were going to hear the Michigan case, it was inevitable. And a few of our classmates were very excited, a little nervous, because, as you know, this decision could make or break the difference of having a diverse educational system in our country. So we talked about it and we decided the need for students, law students' voice to be heard was just so important, especially students at Howard. As you know, we have gigantic footsteps that we follow from, you know, various leaders in our institution, and we just felt that if we sat back and didn't do anything, that it would just, it would be a disgrace to Thurgood Marshall and others. And that's just what we felt was important. We talked to some of the professors, trying to get interest, find out what we could do, and this was right before winter break. And winter break happened, and we decided we were going to talk over the break, see, figure out a plan and what we were going to do. And then we came back to school, realized, I think we came back to school on January 6th, and we realized that the brief was due January 18th. Now, I don't know if any of you are law students or if you know a lot about the law, but it takes a lot to write a brief, especially if we've never written one before.
And to the Supreme Court.
And to the Supreme Court. I mean, this wasn't just like one of our briefs that we were submitting to our legal writing professor or whatnot. This was going not only to the Supreme Court of the United States, but also on behalf of Howard University. And so to do this, we knew that it had to be of superior quality and that it had to have a valid, strong legal argument that really, really represented what the university stands for. And basically, we know as students at Howard University School of Law that we're taught under this assumption that lawyers should be social engineers, and that's really why we decided that we, without a voice, it just, I don't know how to explain it anymore, that it was worth sleepless nights, it was worth all of the hard work that we put in, and we can honestly say that, look, Howard is speaking, this is why it's important, and hopefully the Supreme Court, I mean, we don't know if they'll read it or not. I think there's been over 80-something amicus briefs that were submitted. So maybe they will, maybe they won't. But nevertheless, it's always going to be there, and it will be part of history that says, you know what, we are part of history. So now I'm going to turn it over to my classmate, and she's going to explain kind of the strategy, how we went about as far as the legal argument that we made in the brief.
Hi, my name is Nadine Jones-Francis, and I'm a 3L at Howard Law School as well. As Robin already noted, we did not have a lot of time to go into great philosophical debates. We wanted to keep the brief strictly legal, and we made the strategic decision that legally speaking, it would be to our advantage to stay away from terms such as affirmative action. Now, we can talk about that later on, I mean, in this discussion panel, but we felt rather than, I mean, we have, excuse me, we have 30 pages to work with, and so rather than try to deconstruct what most people think of when they hear the term affirmative action, which is remedial-based, race-based schemes that Mark just spoke about, we said we're just going to focus on the term diversity, since the legal test for affirmative action was, in my opinion, close to impossible to meet. Adirond and Croson, in our opinion, basically shut the door on a lot of remedial-based schemes. And first and foremost, Michigan is not admitting to having done any type of discrimination in the past. So that was a closed door for us. So we stuck with the race diversity, and we made sure to say that you know, the benefits that would flow from a diverse student body flowed to both minorities and non-minorities alike. We wanted to get the court away from the Adirond Croson. We wanted them to focus on racial integration. We wanted them to focus on societal integration. We wanted them to see Brown when they saw Michigan. And that's what we focused on. I don't know how that's going to play out the further we take the issue away from race or from remedial-based schemes, which could very well be problematic. But we dealt with the law that we had and did our best with 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks.
Let me just make another introduction. I have something to do here. I think it's important to recognize that the students have finished the presentation that one of the attractive things for those of us in political science about the contributions of the law school and its student faculty is that it set a national standard that certainly attracted people like me to this university. And it was the idea that students and faculty worked together in the earlier years, and the idea and the hope that they were working together and confronting issues like affirmative action. So I was particularly moved and inspired by the efforts of this group of students. And while we will applaud them later, I think it's worth applauding them now. But I was not surprised by the leadership of the faculty, and I'm glad to be able to present Harold McDougall as well, who, when I called some friends of mine, I like Jay Stewart here, to ask people who to talk, and they said, oh, you must have Harold McDougall, please.
Oh, what they say, no good deed goes unpunished. I approached this issue with the head of an academic and also as a person who was involved with the... With the NAACP as the Washington Bureau Chief. I'm going to pass around a diagram. This microphone is catching up. It's catching everything. I teach a course called Civil Rights Planning at the law school, and one of the things that I talk to students about is that as lawyers, your role in the struggle for social change and for civil rights has to be in the context of the other things that are going on in the community. Even Charles Hamilton Houston particularly looked at, when he talked about lawyers being social engineers, can everybody hear me? Yes? Oh, okay. I'm on the stand, he says, all right. And, you know, kick the microphone while I'm at it. Anyway, that Charles Hamilton Houston, as a social engineer, really understood that there is a very dynamic interaction between law and society. Let me just say this. I would really like us to think about the Grutter case in the context of Brown versus Board of Education. I mean, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of it. It's very important. The whole thrust of Brown versus Board of Education was the desegregation of education. Certainly in this country we have a history where it was a crime to teach a slave to read. In Louisiana, the penalty for violating that that law was death. We have a long history of segregated education in this country that with certain kinds of predictable results. But the reality is right now that almost 50 years after Brown, for many black students, desegregation is not an option. With the end of the so-called metropolitan remedies and busing, the majority of elementary and secondary school students in black students in this country remain in poorly funded, ill-equipped, inner suburban schools in which the teachers and administrators are often white, with negative attitudes towards the students themselves. Since local schools are funded by the property tax, gross disparities occur in funding of education in schools based on the wealth of the community in which they are located. Many suburban schools are essentially private schools in this respect, protected by exclusionary zoning as well as by the price of purchasing a home. Gerrymandering of districts, school districts within suburban jurisdictions further protects these enclaves even from those minorities who have managed to escape the inner city. Even where desegregation has been accomplished, black students face bias in teaching strategies, curriculum, textbooks, instructional materials, teacher staff and administrator attitudes and testing procedures, as well as discriminatory application of tracking, special education classifications, and discipline. In this environment, affirmative action of campuses that are not part of this neighborhood school system has emerged as the only viable means of achieving desegregation in America's school system today, from top to bottom. That is, at the level of undergraduate, graduate, and professional education. That's the holding pattern that we're in. That's the only place, really, that we can talk about integration of education today. And these strategies reach only those children who are able to go to college. Even those strategies now are at risk, as we hear from our colleagues, as opponents of desegregation have waged a winning battle in court, essentially by standing the Houston, Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall approach on its head. Let me tell you about what that means. Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall decided that the best way to achieve desegregation in this country was to start at the top. If you start at the graduate school level and the professional school level, it would be easier to make the case there that separate but equal didn't work, right? And it would be very difficult for the state, for example, to find the resources to create a separate graduate school, a separate law school, separate medical school. So they started there, and they worked their way down to the secondary schools and the elementary schools. The opposition to integration in this country has done just the reverse. They started at the elementary and the secondary school level, where they knew that the most support would be found for their position, and they won. I mean, the courts have dismantled busing, they've dismantled metropolitan remedies, a whole variety of remedies, so that we have the very, very dismal picture for the education of black students at the elementary and secondary school level that I've talked about, and now they're kind of working their way back up the ladder. The diagram that I passed out to you is a diagram of what we might call educational racism, the structure. You start out with observable differences, right? Black students are in virtually all black enclaves or 50% minority enclaves. They do poorly on standardized tests. There's a high level of disciplinary problems, special education, this type of thing. Those are facts that anybody can see. But then the question gets to be, what do you make of that? What do you believe about those facts? That's the next level of the pyramid. Fewer people are involved in kind of getting ideas about what all that means. Some people think that the reason why black kids are in these schools and that they don't do so well is because they're inferior, right? Other people feel that it's because of racism and oppression. You have this kind of dialogue between them. Built on the level of belief is custom and practice. There are fewer people who have beliefs about these facts and still fewer who act on them. Custom and practice is the teacher who sees a black boy of maybe, 7, 8 years old in third grade acting in a very energetic fashion. Okay, if their belief is that the reason why black people are in the position they're in is because they're inferior or it's their own fault, they're going to think there's something wrong with this kid. He's emotionally disturbed. He should be put into some kind of special education situation, right? On the other hand, if the teacher believed that the kid was maybe came from a family in which the diet was rich in fast foods, right? Understand that there's a lot of salt and sugar in that, causing the kid to be energetic. So it might go different ways. From these customs and practices grow institutions, and the primary institution that we have to be considered with here is called resegregation. Like I said, even in integrated situations, black kids face teachers who have the attitude that if they're aggressive, it's because they're troublemakers, right? They have attitudes that a kid who shows a lot of energy in class is not a precocious kid, not a smart kid, not a kid who really wants the teacher's attention and wants to achieve, but a kid who's trying to make trouble, right? These things accumulate into patterns. Then above the level of institutions and patterns, we have organizations. We have specific units that are set up to perpetuate a certain way of looking at these problems. On the one hand, we have the NAACP, and we know what their position is. On the other hand, we have a group called the Center for Individual Rights, which has been mobilizing at the top level of this structure that we've talked about to essentially shut down diversity, if you will, I would say desegregation in graduate and professional school education. And again, at the top level is law, in which the fewest people actually participate, but which has a great impact on this whole structure. The point I want to make, and I don't want to take any more time, is that in order to respond to educational racism, which is displayed for you as this pyramid, you have to attack it at every level. At the level of observable differences, you have to really change the actual school environment of black children. Otherwise, those differences will remain, and they will be asking for an explanation. And the kinds of explanations that can come up, we've already talked about what that can be. At the level of belief, through media public information campaigns, demonstrations, media access, you have to begin to try to change what people believe about the facts that we all know are there. At the level of custom and practice, we're looking at teacher retraining. We're talking about something that we started in the NAACP called parents' councils. These are like the PTA, except they're, they're all, minority folks, and they're trying to promote a minority agenda in education. Institutions, we need to begin to develop more think tanks that can develop new strategies. We are on the, we're on the defensive as far as the generation of new strategies is concerned. Organizations. The NAACP right now has a very interesting program that they're initiating. It's called a call to action, And their idea is to organize parents in every state of the country and to begin to lobby for legislation that will be passed at the state level. We may have some trouble in Congress with certain kinds of legislation, you know, despite our stalwart colleague here, you know, to represent us. But there are some things that we can do in state legislatures that are not possible in federal legislatures right now. But the idea then again, you know, just like they did with the Proposition 13, is to build some momentum in the state legislatures that might then put pressure on the Congress to pass something that, you know, we might call the Fair Education Act, right? You have the Fair Housing Act, something like the Fair Education Act, that would talk about the disparity of funding in minority schools, teacher retraining, better curriculum, and also the issues of diversity and desegregation that we're talking about. And then at the level of law, again, I've just mentioned that we look at certain kinds of new legislation. We look at the continuing battles over the equalization of school finance, a very important type of litigation that's being carried on at state level in state courts. One of the things that you have to learn as an activist and as an academic is to know when to shut up, and I'm going to do that right now.
Thank you, Professor Dougal. It's always a pleasure to have the opportunity of having superstars from places like Capitol Hill, but you know they have a public service agenda, so we are blessed occasionally with a visit, especially those who are committed. Yeah, but it is sometimes give you pause to have a superstar on campus that is brand new, a new superstar. And so I was told in inviting him that you should go ahead and invite him. He's a normal-looking person. So I'm pleased to introduce the former mayor of Baltimore and the dean of the law school and a normal-looking person, Dean Smoke.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. I appreciate the normal-looking introduction. This is a real pleasure for me to participate on this panel, and I, too, will follow my colleague, Professor McDougal, in being brief. I'm from the school that believes that a speech, in order to be immortal, need not be eternal. So I just kind of give it to you short and sweet and let you make judgments from there. But let me first not only thank Professor Marsh, but thank Congressman Shaka Fatah for being here. We're discussing a Supreme Court case, at its very root, what's happening here, and Professor McDougal alluded to it, what is occurring now is a political agenda being played out through the courts. And if you have to appreciate that and understand that there is a need for all types of people, all groups, from our Congress people, the students, the various community organizations, non-governmental organizations, academics, those who are in the law, those who are not in the law, to let the court know that you care about this issue and see it as a part of a greater political agenda. Now, I was mayor of Baltimore for 12 years, from 1987 to 1999. And watch this issue, this kind of attack on affirmative action, played out in municipal services, in education, in higher education, and many other ways. I'm particularly concerned about this specific attack through the University of Michigan, because I see it in a not only this political agenda context, but as you look through the sweep of American history, I don't think that it is an exaggeration to view these cases as potentially now as significant as Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, as the Brown case, as the Bakke case. The reason that I say that is that in its broadest context, if the ruling of this court is simply, it comes down and says that race cannot be considered at all in any aspect of higher education. No consideration of, then what's at issue here? What's at stake? Scholarships that may be race-based. The historically black college and university initiative that is race-based. Funding for research that might be race-based. All types of things that you now see and kind of take for granted. Half the revenue from this university, annual revenue flow for this university, comes as an appropriation from Congress. Why? Because of the historic mission of this university. It has already been attacked by one of the groups that Professor McDougall mentioned. They tried to attack Howard's appropriation through the Congress. That was beat down. But maybe they'll go a back door through the courts and try to argue that this appropriation is a remnant of past, it's a remnant of a different era, it is race-based, arguably, they would say, and so it should be ended. What would happen? Think about the quality of this place if all of a sudden half the revenues, the annual revenues of Howard were actually cut off. I brought you, I only have a couple of copies because I knew that Robin and Nadine would talk about this is the brief that Howard submitted. And if you haven't seen it, I'm going to have two copies up here just for you to leaf through so you can see what it takes. The students did a brief just like this one that requires very high level of argument and analysis and presented to the Supreme Court. And you can see what your university has said about this issue. President Swigert decided that Howard, in addition to the law students, that the university itself should go on record as focusing not on some of the, all the questions that are presented in the case, but particularly on the issue of race consciousness. His belief was that race consciousness was still permissible in higher education. The court should not overrule, make the broadest possible ruling. It should not overrule Bakke. It should allow universities to make decisions and, in fact, include race in their consideration. Two other points on this matter. The impact of the of these cases and the political agenda in fighting against affirmative action we've already seen in the last few weeks. Some of you may know, you're following this, two major universities, Virginia Tech and MIT, had summer programs that were focused on minority students. They wanted to, for a variety of reasons, historical whatever, provide this opportunity for minority students who were going to enroll to come early and involve themselves in programs at MIT and at Virginia Tech. They have now disbanded those programs, saying they can't offer them because they are race-based, and they fear, these universities fear, the Office of Civil Rights will come after them, saying that you can't do that. You, if you continue, that you will lose your federal funding. Quite a hammer to have over a university. When you think about the kind of the basic political agenda, remember timetable. We've got had 300 years of problems with race or more racial discrimination in this country. We have a civil war ending in 1865, but we had Plessy in 1896, you know, saying that this separate, this discrimination is okay, and only about 58 years then up until the Brown case that Robin and Nadine alluded to, did we have that turned over. So we've got 1954, the Brown case, very important, making a step forward on equal opportunity in this country. 1964, a Civil Rights Act, which really starts us getting moving. But so 1964 to 1978, a blink of an eye. 1978 is when the Bakke case comes down. So all of a sudden, this, you got 14 years, basically, of fairly aggressive action in trying to remedy 300 and some years of racial problems in our country. And since 1978, as the professor mentioned, it's just been slow but steady attacks, eroding the aggressive fight for equal opportunity. And now it's my belief that the political agenda carries through with the Gratz and Grutter case. One just factual matter that please remember, you all probably know about the you know, the differences between the two cases, that undergraduate case where the president says it was a quota that he's looking at the fact that the undergraduate case, the University of Michigan assigned a certain number of points, 150 points for applicants. If you got your 150 points, you were admitted. 20 of those points were granted to you if you were a member of certain racial groups. But what they didn't tell you was that how the other 130 points came into play, and that included things like being a legacy child, that is, being the son or daughter of somebody who had graduated from the university. Of course, that's not considered affirmative action because President Bush got into Yale that way. These types of things they don't tell you. And the other thing that I'm sure many of you don't know is that many white students were admitted to the University of Michigan the same year these students didn't get in, claiming that they didn't get in because so many non-whites were admitted. But there are many whites who got admitted with less qualifications. That is, if you just look at SAT and GPA, there are a number of white students that got in also. That because they had other characteristics, that they were artists, they were poets, they were football players, they were people who had other qualifications that the university found to be interesting and allowed them to be admitted. So in any event, I just wanted to come by and not only thank all these the people who've been involved in supporting this issue, but I to also praise in particular our students, and as one little commercial, to invite you to apply for admission to the Howard University School of Law. We continue to draw from the best and the brightest all over the country. We now, your university's law school has currently on campus students from 90 different colleges and universities throughout North America and the Caribbean. We look forward to getting many, many more great qualified applicants from Howard University, because we want to continue the tradition that our students talked about, not only Charles Hamilton Houston, a great dean of the law school, but Thurgood Marshall and Robert Carter and many other giants in the law who were involved in litigating these cases. Howard University School of Law was vitally important, prominently figured into the fight for equal opportunity in the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, and we're still on the case and still at the center and still very aggressively fighting for social justice in this century. Thank you all very much.
I think we've had a great set of panel presentations, and now is the chance to have a discussion. And I would suggest that you direct your particular comments or questions to a particular speaker. And I would be happy to open the floor if they are all prepared to do so. We first acknowledge the chairman of the History Department, Dr. Henry Colbert. Are there any questions or comments?
My question is directed to Mr. Dan. You were talking about scripture and all those factors that go into race-conscious remedies. I was wondering, what is the constitutional basis for affirmative action, if anyway?
I'm sorry, can you clarify the question? What is the constitutional basis?
Yeah, is there anything in the Constitution that the Supreme Court or that President Johnson derived to actually put in the plan affirmative action?
Nothing directly in the Constitution would require affirmative action in the broader sense of the term. I think what you're looking at is an arc of history. The term affirmative action was first used in, as many of you probably are aware, an executive order. So there are race-conscious measures that were designed, particularly with President Nixon and since, and it's worth noting that in terms of amicus briefs to the Supreme Court, this is the first time, particularly in an education case, where the administration, a president, has opposed or gone in outside in opposition to race-conscious admissions policies. But there is nothing that requires a state government or a federal government to take action, absent, for example, as I alluded to earlier, perhaps a court saying you must take these particular remedies as a court order to remedy past discrimination. But there's nothing that says a state must do it. In many instances, what you're looking at are, for the first time in history, universities or state governments that are waking up and saying, you know, this is a problem. It is reality. We look at the numbers, and we're not going to ignore them. We are going to take these affirmative actions to eliminate these difficulties.
Thank you. My question is directed to the gentleman right here. Do you think that the discussion of affirmative action should be started with literacy instead of maybe it led before it gets to the courts? Because you were talking about teachers need to be better trained. And like you're saying, if a teacher thinks that a student, you know, is wild and they can't learn, and the student goes through, you know, college, and, I mean, goes through high school, middle school, and they can't read, and it's time to apply to college, they really won't have, you know, the credentials. I think the discussion needs to start with literacy, then, you know, students can have something more to bring to the table.
Well, I think that, I don't know if everybody heard his question. Did everybody hear his question? Basically, he asked if I thought that we should start with literacy. I mean, start with, you know, kind of improving competitiveness of black students, you know, at the minority students at the basic level. I would just say, and again, you know, I kind of refer to the pyramid that I sent around. You have to approach everything. There really is no one place to start. I think that part of it is, you know, to take a, I hate to use this metaphor, you know, given what's going on, but I think you kind of take targets of opportunity. I think that, you know, to the extent that you can improve with some kind of focused demonstration or activity, improve the reading levels of children at the elementary and secondary level, you've done some good. I think that if you can defend affirmative action, diversity at the university level, you've done some good. I think what you have to really look at, though, is to approach the thing comprehensively, because if you just attack one part of it, it'll just kind of show up someplace else. I couldn't resist a comment, though. This young man asked if there was any kind of justification for affirmative action. And I may be kind of setting a bomb off here, but the closest thing to a justification, of course, is reparations, right? I mean, there's a way in which affirmative action is kind of reparations on the installment plan, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's a little tiny bit of reparations, but that's part of what the justification of it is, for it is.
Let me just jump in for that. I think that part of the argument that we made in our brief is that we need to improve K-12 education and make sure that young people are getting a fair education. But that was for the purposes of making that argument before the court. In this room, I think people should understand that this is an attack broader than just whether or not African Americans are going to be admitted to medical school or law school or to a college somewhere. This is an attack at the question of whether or not race can be taken into account in any way in terms of policies to remedy either past discrimination or present discrimination. That is that there's no circumstance under which the federal government has looked at employment, housing, education, in which if you're an African American, you're not getting you're not being put in a deficit position, notwithstanding your qualifications, that because of your race, you are going to be denied opportunities as a general course in this country. And what these people at the Center for Individual Rights are doing is they are trying to use the civil rights laws and affirmative action policies, flip them on their head and say, yeah, life's not fair, but we should act as if we're in a colorblind situation. So whether or not it's a contracting opportunity for your business in which next to none might be going to African-American or women-owned businesses, they have worked and have stopped almost effectively much of the programs designed to steer businesses to businesses that have been left out. And now they've moved into education. And so whatever argument that you want to make to try to persuade people is one thing, but you need to understand that this is not an issue of whether or not you know, if in fact you showed up and you had the same SAT score as somebody else, you know, and so forth and so on, would you be let in? If it's a subjective decision left to people who don't look like you, more often than not, you're not going to get in, given all that we know about the society that we live in. So now that's what happens in the real world. And affirmative action has been a way to try to create pressures on these systems so that people take into account that they will be held accountable if there's not a fair representation of groups in our society that should be included.
Congressman, can I just real quick follow up on that because of the real world issues? When I was mayor of Baltimore, we had a program that required for any contract over $25,000, which is the majority, I mean, most of our contracting, but any contract over $25,000, you had to have 20% minority participation, 3% women business owner participation at minimally 20 and 3. We had a large number of minority contractors in the metropolitan area, that is Baltimore City, Baltimore County. Baltimore County did not have a law like ours that where it made an affirmative effort to include minority contractors. In Baltimore County, the participation level of minority contractors was less than 2%. Same people, same business owners, but because there was no affirmative effort out in Baltimore County, they got almost no business out there, whereas in the city, the majority of our contracts that I just talked about all included substantial minority and women business participation. That's the reality of what's going on out in our society. If you don't have somebody affirmatively paying attention to this issue, then you're going to see the resegregation in all different kinds of activities in our community.
I have a question. I'll take advantage of the mic here. In 78, after the Bakke decision, and I reiterate the point that the Congressman made as well as the Dean, or it probably exaggerates the point, in 78, many people in the social science community said that